Hi, guys. We want to thank our great sponsor, Legion M. They are the first fan-owned entertainment company. We love working with them. They create really incredible experiences for people. If you're someone who wants to feel like you own a piece and are a piece of the industry, it's a great way to do it. They do meetups all over the country. They have a really cool community going online. I cannot recommend them enough. Go to legionm.com for more information.
Hi, I'm Leonard Maltin.
And I'm Jesse Maltin.
And you're listening to Maltin on Movies. And Jesse and I are looking at someone whose face you would know as well as we do, because she's been in so many movies and TV shows, and she happens to be in some of the best movies of the past decade.
It's true.
Our not-so-humble opinion. if you saw Leave No Trace this year with Ben Foster, she's there. If you saw Hell or High Water, she's there. If you saw Winter's Bone, that remarkable film that launched Jennifer Lawrence's career, she's there. Because she's, and Jesse said, I first saw her on True Blood.
No, even before that.
Yeah.
But that's when we were trying to think of what people would know. This is Dale Dickey, by the way.
And her
Hello,
name.
Hello, Dale Dickey.
Her name is Dale Dickey. Hi, Dale.
Hello.
But I was trying to think of what episodic people would know. Because obviously my name is Earl is a big one. But yeah, True Blood, being the badass werewolf that are.
Yeah.
Pretty damn
it's
cool.
It's usually either True Blood where, my name is Earl, where they'll call out, you're the hooker. I'm like, can you clarify that? That was on television. True Blood. And then I did the nasty turn as the skank on Breaking Bad, which unfortunately most people recognize this face from. I'm like, really? Because I spent 3 hours of makeup getting lesions and looking even worse.
Ow.
It's okay. You know, I stand by ATM machines and just wait for people to come.
Well, welcome, Dale.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
We're so
for
happy to have
me.
You here. And we only got to have you here because of a happy circumstance.
Serendipity is an amazing thing.
Mm-hmm.
I love going onto the Twitter and telling people, like, let's talk about character actors. Let's talk about the actors who are the supporting. And the thing about the word supporting is it's not small. Supporting means they make the movie. Star is fine, but if a star, in the same way an ensemble, you know, when you on stage, yeah. If you're watching and all 15 people standing behind the lead are staring off into the distance, don't know what they're doing, you know, it's a big deal. And so I always try to get people talking about who do you love, who are you into, as soon as you see their name, you get excited. And your name always comes up when we have this conversation, which is why it's so crazy.
That's very nice.
We're at the LA Film Critics Awards dinner, and I'm standing there, and I look over, and I think I see you in the lobby. And I think, why would she be here? No. And I look back again, and I have a damn heart attack and go running for my dad. And I said, Dale Dickey is here! And as he can attest, that is exactly what I did. And I dragged him back over, and then you disappeared from the lobby. And I thought, I actually am seeing things. I'm now willing Dale Dickey into my life.
Oh my.
And I'm now seeing things that she's here.
But actually were there with your husband.
Yep.
I was. He says hello,
he's
by the way.
I'll say hi to us.
We were thrilled to meet you guys. Steve's been.
And you were there in support of Deborah Granik's terrific film, Leave No Trace.
Absolutely.
Which deserves all the accolades one can heap upon it.
I think so, too. Thank you. Yeah, it's an extraordinary
film. And your second time working with Deborah.
I know, and I hope there's more.
There will be.
She's just a very, very special director. Mm-hmm. And I know people bandy that word about, but I adore her and the whole crew, Michael McDonough, the same cinematographer, Ann Rossellini, the co-writer. So, you know, having done Winter's Bone, when Leave No Trace came up, they had contacted my agent and said, we have a role we'd like for Dale to look at for our next film. And I was like, I'll sweep your floor.
I'm jumping out of order, which annoys my co-host a bit.
No. I always want to know where people start.
And we're going to do that.
Okay.
But I have to say that one thing about this role in Leave No Trace is that you play a sympathetic character, which you don't often get to do.
No.
And you are kind of the part of the heart and soul of the movie,
mm-hmm.
because you reach out. It's not a spoiler to say you lend a helping hand to these two troubled souls,
right?
And who really need a helping hand.
They do. And yeah. And you're right. I sort of, when I first saw it, I thought people are waiting for me to have a chainsaw, a shotgun, or an ATM machine. Something bad is going to happen. And it was nice and refreshing to be sort of the helping hand, mm-hmm. which...
Well, it's a lovely role and a really terrific movie.
Yeah.
So you're a native of Tennessee.
I am. And in Tennessee, you always hear it, East Tennessee, because Tennessee's a long state, so it's mm-hmm. very different from Memphis to Nashville. Knoxville, where I'm from, is near the Appalachian Mountains. It's close to Dolly Parton, mm-hmm. Dollywood.
Dollywood. Mm-hmm. It's my dream to go to Dollywood.
I've always said if I have to leave this business here and go back there, I can get a job churning butter at Dollywood and telling old Appalachian stories.
I didn't know that was an option, but now I have a goal.
I don't know if it
now
is.
I have
to talk to Dolly about hiring me, but, you know.
Let's go find
but
Dolly.
But it's good to have goals.
Yes, thank you. Yes,
yes. So when did you get the acting bug? How young? How early?
I was about 9. Mm-hmm. The University of Tennessee in Knoxville has, of course, a big football program, but they had an unusually strong theater program, which a lot of people don't know. There was a wonderful director named Clarence Brown from the 30s.
Oh, the Clarence Brown?
The Clarence Brown did National Velvet, The Yearling, yeah. Anna Karenina, Anna Christie.
Oh, enormous credit.
He was had moved to Knoxville when he was a child and then went to the university and came to Hollywood from there. So in the 70s, Knoxville had a thriving theater scene, but it was basically sort of a tent theater that they had made into a full theater in the round. He gave a lot of money, like around the early 70s, to build a big new proscenium theater and arts program. And so the big Clarence Brown Theater has been there. It's a Lort company. They've had a professional company in residence since the 70s. So it's a great training ground. And they have, his wife, I think, continued to bequeath money.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fabulous training ground for a liberal arts college. And as a child, they also had a summer theater up in Gatlinburg in the mountains, and they would do things like Sound of Music. So, of course, hello. I was a Von Trapp child twice. First I was Marta when I was 9, the one that nobody remembers. And then I think a few years later, I moved up to Brigida, the bratty book.
Marta's important. She gets to scoot her little butt up at the end of the song.
You're right. Marta is, because she's important. But even Maria goes, I don't know about her yet. I don't know, something. But, you know, I knew I was never going to go on to play Liesl or Maria, so I enjoyed my time. But the university just, my mother had grown up, both my parents had attended, had gone to UT, and she was very involved, my mom, in the theater scene. She took me to see everything. And once I started doing plays as a child, I didn't want to stop, you know. I was like, Mom, can I do another play? And then they would call and say, could Dale be in the crowd of the Shakespeare play? We need a couple of kids. And she always let me do it. So I grew up doing like 3 shows a year at the university, always pretending that I was going to be a veterinarian instead because I loved animals.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew I wanted to be an actress. So I ended up, of course, went to school there to study. And then, you know, and then I left for New York. So it's just, as a kid, I remember seeing a production of The Tempest, where Prospero, there was no lights, and he broke open this tiny toy ship, and then this bolt of lightning came in, and it was this magical island, and I was like, I just want to live in magic land, you know. So, of course, as a child, it was a wonderful escape and fantasy.
Sure.
But that's how I got started.
Well, it's a good way to get started, yeah. And your parents approved.
They did. Now, my parents were divorced when I was very little, but they both still lived in Knoxville. My mother was much more supportive in the beginning because my dad was concerned about me missing school, mm-hmm. and being up late, you know, not doing my homework, all those things that happened.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was getting a great education at the university and doing what I wanted to do and being around a loving environment. So, yes, and over the years, they both... You know, I've been very lucky to have the support of my family and my friends, even though they were worried and scared at times.
Sure, as parents always are.
Yeah, yeah.
But so when did you make the big move to New York?
I moved to New York in 1984.
Wow.
you know, the university, the actors they brought in for the Clarence Brown Company were all from New York, so that's who I grew up apprenticing with.
Ah, good.
And
so you had a place to go.
I had a place to go. I had, you know, yes. And I knew there were a couple of, like, Johnny Collins from Knoxville, Tennessee, and a wonderful actress named Carol Mayo Jenkins was also from Knoxville. So I sort of had a couple of those. David Keith came out of Knoxville. Mm-hmm. I'd known David as a child. I did Wizard of Oz with him. I was on Munchkin. He was the Cowardly Lion. I wanted to marry him. And now he's like a big brother to me, and I just adore David. But so I did, you know, I still moved up there pretty much knowing nothing and on my own. But I was maybe never going to be homeless because I did have people I could go to, you know, if I needed a couch to sleep on.
So you, as an apprentice and a newcomer, were you just a sponge soaking everything up you could?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I used to get teased in high school, well, for several things, but everybody said I talked funny, and I was like, I'm doing Shakespeare at the university. I don't know how I sound, you know. I was learning Shakespeare and Atlantic Standard stage speech and all of that. Just soaking it up. I just loved it. I worked, you know, the University of Tennessee, and as a theater major, you have to do everything. You have to work backstage. You have to be a stage manager, lighting, sound, you know. And I did my best at all of those things. Not so well, but the acting was my strength. But I loved the theater community, and I just, you know, I love standing in the wings and watching performances. I love when I'm on a film set, coming in early, even if I'm not working, and watching the other actors work. It's just, that's how I learn.
Well, it's a great way to learn.
Yeah.
And what a wonderful, vast amount of experience you've acquired doing that.
Yeah, I was very lucky. Yeah. Plus, I couldn't do anything else. There was nothing else I could do.
So when did you first start getting parts, and which were meaningful to you early on?
Well, theater and film, yes, mostly theater. Mm-hmm. New York was a difficult time for me as an actor. For many people, I loved New York, but at that time, it seemed like unless you came out of one of the league schools, it was hard to get an agent. I had a very rough time getting an agent. They didn't know what to do with me. It was like, you're not pretty enough this way, you're not strange enough that way. And so I couldn't do anything else. I don't know what it was about the rejection. I went to all the open calls, get up at 5 in the morning and go stand online at Equity. I waitressed. I did so many odd jobs. I did tons of little theater workshops. I worked at Theater for the New City and a lot of experimental theaters. And then I started working as a reader for some casting directors. My first, I guess, big theater break was in 1988. Excuse me. I was waiting tables at a restaurant on the Upper West Side. And there was a gentleman there that said, are you an actress? I really like Southern actors. I'm part of this play downtown that's doing really well, and I always look for Southern actors to cast. You're right for a couple of roles. And I said, what's the play? It was Steel Magnolias.
Oh, my God.
Well, I still didn't know who he was. It was Robert Harling, the playwright, and I just figured he was a stage manager or something, right. And I'd waited on him at brunch. He goes, no, I'd like for you to get you tickets, go see the show. If you like it and you're interested, we'll keep you in mind. So I did, and I instantly fell in love. And, you know, I'm sure he was always thought of me as a Nell, which is what I went on to play. But, you know, when I emailed, we didn't have email, but I would send him my mailings. I'm doing this little play. I was working with an improv company called Manhattan Punchline at the time. Come see me in this stupid little workshop. And, you know, finally, like 6 months later, I get a call to go downtown and audition for Pam Boleyn, the director, as a possible replacement for a Nell, or they were maybe going to do a national tour or whatever. They ended up doing a Chicago run, and they took me to Chicago in 1988. I was in Chicago for a full year, did that role for a year.
Wow.
And then ironically, a year later in New York, and I had so many bad experiences with open calls. Normally, they don't really cast from open calls. They're required to do them, and it's a cattle call. But it was all I could do. It was like, if I don't have an agent getting me out. Well, I had literally decided I'm not going to open backstage. I'm not going to go to these anymore. And I opened the Backstage that week, and I saw that
Backstage was the weekly newspaper that
still is.
Yeah,
yeah.
The Bible.
The Bible, right? You know, and
every role, whatever audition.
Exactly, and I saw that they were casting for a production of The Merchant of Venice, which was coming from London to New York with Dustin Hoffman as Shylock and the British company. But they were going to have to recast some Americans in the ensemble and as understudies. And I was like, oh, my God.
That could be me.
I could do that. I could do Nerissa and Jessica. And I'd studied Shakespeare. I'd gone to England in 1986 to study on a summer thing. And I ended up studying under Brian Cox, who was my main teacher.
Oh my
Can you imagine? He was fabulous. But I was just like, I know I can do this. I'm going to go to this open call. Why not? Well, it was just my luck of the draw. I was there on a day when they had a real representative there. So when I got a call back, I was floored. And I got a call back, and then I get the call to come to the theater and read for Sir Peter Hall. And then I started, like, feeling sick.
At the mention of Sir Peter Hall, we take a pause, and we're doing a deep bow.
right.
You can't see it, but we're doing a deep bow.
But I, long story short, I was put into the ensemble. I was part of Portia's train. I stood a lot holding one of her casket things. And I understudied Jessica and Nerissa and never got to go on, but I stood in the wings and watched and talked to Dustin about, you know, he goes, you want to go on, don't you? Because he'd been an understudy for many times, too. So it was a glorious experience. But I remember Robert Harling came backstage, maybe because the movie had come out, but he was me, and he saw me, and he went, okay, I'm claiming credit for this because it all started with me waiting on his table.
Brian Cox.
I know.
I'm not done with that yet.
Oh, my God. This was 1986. It was a summer program through Yale called the British American Drama Academy, BADA, we called it. But it was brand new at that time, like maybe 4 or 5 years old. And they took a lot of students. You auditioned through Earl Gister, who was teaching at Yale at that time, who was our Chekhov teacher, who was so brilliant. But over there in Oxford, you were broken up into groups, and you each had like a couple of directors and then an actor that taught you different classes. Mm-hmm. So I just happened to end up with Brian Cox's acting group. And he had me work on Strange Interlude, which I guess he'd done with Glenda Jackson.
Mm-hmm.
It was remarkable.
Sounds glorious.
And we would go in. He was doing some productions in London at the time. I know Les Liaisons was there with Alan Rickman. Mm-hmm. But Brian was doing some obscure, The White Devil. I can't think of it. It was some obscure classical play. So we got to see him on stage and then go back the next day and be in class with him.
Wow.
I know, and I've been able to keep in touch with him. I've been able to see him. I was in New York when he was doing that championship season, and I got to go backstage and visit with him.
So. Oh, that's incredible.
Yeah.
And so you finally had some credits under your belt,
mm-hmm.
as well as experience we know you had.
Yeah.
And now you started to have some credits under your belt.
And nothing happened. It was always up and down, and I finally was able to get an agent who would sort of back pocket you and freelance with you. And I did an NYU student film like in 92. We filmed on a cotton farm down in Arkansas. It was just beautiful. And then the first film break was a TV series called Christie, which was on like in 93 and 94 and got bumped around on CBS. But it was Tyne Daly, Kelly Martin, true story of a woman that goes as a missionary in the Appalachians in the turn mm-hmm. of the last century. And they were casting local people as supporting roles. And I was like, well, if I'm right for anything, it's an Appalachian mountain role. Hello. And I ended up getting cast in a nice recurring role, playing Tess Harper's sister.
Mm-hmm.
So working with Tess and Tyne Daly and a wonderful director named Michael Rhodes, mm-hmm. my first really on-camera experience. I had a lot of emotional, deep things to do, and he was wonderful because I was pretty terrified. And then that was an inspiration to move here. I'd been wanting to move to L.A. I was still doing regional theater out of New York,
mm-hmm.
But couldn't quite get in the circuit. And
breaking in is so
it's
tough.
It is.
For anybody.
Yeah.
And my hat is off to anyone who stays the course.
It's brave. I say this to people often because I don't think they give themselves enough credit. To move away from home in general is brave. To move to a city you've never been to is brave.
Yeah.
But beyond that, auditions and putting yourself out there again and again and again, and basically you're basically standing in front of people naked.
Mm-hmm.
And being told, that's okay. Like, thank you so much.
Next.
You know, we're going to need you to sob uncontrollably and then vomit into the toilet.
Right,
thank
right.
you, next. You know, it's this sort of a thing. And I don't think it's a very brave thing to do.
It is. It is. It's a strange thing to do. On one hand, the constant rejection, but I didn't want to do anything else. And I think if I had not gotten supportive feedback from, I go to these open calls and I meet the casting directors that ran like Playwrights Horizons or some of the other off-Broadway theaters. And they're like, we really love your work, but you need an agent. And they'd keep me on file.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I'd start working as a reader for some of their things, I would be like, well, God, I could do this role. But then I'd look at the list of the 20 women, and, you know, of course they're going to see these 20 women. They all had names, and they were all brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
So I just kept at it, and making the transition to L.A. was very scary because I thought, I cannot move to another new city and not have an agent. I can't go through that again.
Yeah.
And I luckily had worked with in a theater production in Denver Center Theater, with a director named Randy Mylar, who had a boutique agency he'd been with for years, and they loved theater actors. So came to L.A. for 6 weeks. They signed me. Not everybody in the office liked me, but one woman did. So that's usually the case. And so I made the decision to come here. And I had also done it was originally a student film. It went on to do quite well indie-wise, The Incredible True Adventures of Two Girls in Love.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly True Adventures of Two Girls in Love, like in New York in 95. Played the LA Film Festival, so
mm-hmm.
it sort of was timing with that. The people I knew from Christie, and I just bit the bullet and did it.
Wow.
Now I did. I moved out here with my husband, Steve, and I'd met by then. He's from Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
What does he do?
He's a bartender, career bartender.
So an actor and a bartender walk into it. Yes,
yes, yes. Has nothing to do with the business. Thinks we're all crazy, but has great respect for us.
Wow.
Has been holds my hand,
and he'll
keeps
never
me
starve.
Grounded.
Yeah, right.
And he has a wonderful demeanor. He must be really good.
He's a great guy. And I you guys don't live with me. I can be a handful. I'm really pretty low maintenance, but, you know, there's a boatload of crazy that comes with it. So we drive each other nuts. We still have a too small apartment, but we've been together for 24 years now.
Wow,
so
mazel tov.
That's 23, something. I don't know.
Yeah, something,
long enough.
Something's
long
right.
Enough. A
something's
while.
Something's right.
There. Yeah. Something's right there.
And so what was there a turn out here that you can look back at and say, well, that was the moment when work started to happen and when you started being recognized for that work?
It came in fits and starts again. You know, mm-hmm. everybody talks about your big break, and I think there's a lot of little breaks.
Yeah.
And I have experienced even to this, you know, it's always up and down. It just is. I can go through a period where there's nothing or a lot. My first big, exciting, I'd done a few little guest stars, but then I, out of the blue, got an audition for The Pledge, mm-hmm. which...
A film I love.
Yeah, which Sean Penn directed, and we filmed in 99. And then I went through sort of these years of... I was doing tons of theater out here. I worked with a terrific writer-director named Del Shores that does a lot of Southern.
Of course, he did Sorted Lives.
Sorted Lives.
Which has
Housewife.
A career all its own.
It does. And I have played like multiple characters. But I being a little part of his troupe of actors, he kept me busy in all the lean years. And you play to packed houses, even though it's a small theater, because everybody mm-hmm. loves, you know, not everybody, but mm-hmm. it's an acquired taste. But funny, funny stuff, and then just drop you like that to your knees. So I, after The Pledge, I think it was probably maybe when I started doing My Name is Earl, right around 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I'd also gotten to work with a wonderful Tony Scott on mm-hmm. Domino.
Mm-hmm.
And I think after Earl, things picked up a little bit. Mm-hmm. I started getting a little more recognition and getting more auditions. My agents kept retiring, and I found myself in, like, 2007, right when the crash was, my agent was retiring, and I was like, no, my character actors at this age, nobody's going to bring me in. And it was tough. And I thought, I can't do this again. And just by the luck of the draw, one person that he knew called, and I had just enough credits that they felt like it wasn't developmental, and they brought me in. And then Winter's Bone. And Breaking Bad, and then it just kept going.
All right, let's wind back to The Pledge.
I'm sorry, I'm talking way. Blah, blah, blah.
No, you're talking great. We're interested in all this. That's why we asked you here. All right, now, I love that movie. Directed by Sean Penn, one of the very few. He's done a handful of films by now.
I think he's a good director.
He is a good director.
He's a really good director.
And starring Jack Nicholson in one of his best parts.
Absolutely.
And a fantastic supporting cast.
Oh. Everybody, yeah. It's like crazy.
Top to bottom.
People.
Yeah, yeah. So, and you shot where?
We shot in Vancouver,
mm-hmm.
in and around Vancouver. And, I hope I'm getting it right. I think it's Chris Menges, M-E-N-G-E-S, was our
cinematographer.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I remember hearing that he was choosing some sort of off-the-grid locations on purpose because he was tired of seeing the same thing. Well, it plagued us with weather problems. Mm-hmm. We'd be high up on a mountain, and there'd be a snowstorm, and with all the trucks, and then the rain. So we were up and down in production, but Vancouver was gorgeous, and it was, of course, perfect for this location.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask you.
Jack. Jack.
Yes, Jack. I have a lot of great Jack stories, but I tell you, he's a class act.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was just a gentleman, and I think he knows people are going to be nervous meeting him, but mm-hmm. my first introduction was Sean did several table reads of the script, and he sort of had the main cast in place. I had auditioned for him for one role. It was the role Patricia Clarkson played of mm-hmm. the grieving mother, which is what I usually did. And he already had her in mind, but he said, I really want to use you somewhere. I just don't know where. There's other cops, there's this, there's that. So I did a couple of table reads where I filled in and read some of the other people. Mm-hmm. But my first table read, I go in, and we're waiting on someone, and there's Mr. Nicholson, Jack, and then there's Mickey Rourke. And then there's Harry Dean Stanton over there, and they all had on sunglasses, smoking like fiends. And we were like a conference room at a hotel. And I was introduced, of course, and everything. But I've been a waitress so many times in my life, and so the ashtrays were getting really full. I was smoking at that time, too, and I thought, well, while we're waiting for everything to get started, and there's not a lot of chit-chat going on, so I'm going to take the ashtrays and be nice and dump them. So I take them over to the industrial trash cans there, and I dump them, and I come back, and like 5 minutes later, we smell smoke, and like Sean's getting ready to come back in the room, and the trash can is on fire. And Harry Dean goes, she did it. That little girl, she did it. And it was. That was my. I'm sorry. I said, I'm sorry. I caused a fire, shot. I was getting a little anxious.
It's so nice to meet you. I decided
right.
to set you on fire.
It's so hot in here.
I'm sorry, Sean Penn.
So, yeah, that was my first. And then, of course, my first day on set with Jack. And of course, Sam Shepard was there at this point. I didn't mm-hmm. know he was going to be in it. I was like. And my first line to Jack was something very convoluted, like I used to be able to remember it. Our hardcore crime unit handles that jurisdiction now. Something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just running it before we were filming it, and I was so nervous. And I looked up at Emma, and I started to say the line, and I went, I had to my And I just stopped, and he just gave me that grin. Because shall we try it again?
Oh, my God.
And I was like, yes, please.
Yes.
And from that on, he stayed on set, from my takes, out in the cold, in the snow, when he didn't have to be there.
That's, for anyone who doesn't know, there's obviously different camera angles, but there's something called coverage, which can sort of be all those shots that whenever the camera moves, you've got the main shot that's set up, then you've got his shoulder, her shoulder.
Absolutely.
Well, some actors, if they're not on camera, have a stand-in. And sometimes that's okay, and other times
sometimes it's the assistant script editor.
Yes.
Because you know, the other person still has to act.
Yeah.
The other person still
it's
has
a very
to act
strange
to it.
Thing when that
and so the people who stay, and when you hear those stories about someone like Jack Nicholson, where he could have left and everyone would have understood.
Right.
You know,
right.
And they stay, you say, yeah, that's why you're the real thing.
Yeah, classy,
you know?
Classy.
That's why you're the real thing. He didn't just leave you to figure out your own stuff.
He was very, very supportive and encouraging. And we were all up there for a long time. And then I made the mistake one night. I think it was Sam Shepard's last night, and we were all going to go out. Most of us were in one hotel. Staying at, you know, I was like, mm-hmm. I said, Jack, we're all going to go out to say goodbye to Sam, and can you join us? And he just sort of looked at me like, I'm staying on another planet from you. Because he was in a whole different hotel. He can't just go out like that.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize it. I was so naive. I'm sure I drove them all nuts. But I that was a case of just staying on set and soaking up as much as I could.
Sure. Sure.
Sean let me, you know, watch dailies and look through the camera.
That's very generous, too.
Yeah.
Both very generous. Really took me under his wing, and it was a great experience.
What was he like as a director?
He left you alone a lot
in
a certain way, which is good, but kind of scary for me in the beginning. But it was really just all about trust.
Mm-hmm.
And he sometimes would wait until sort of the last minute to give you the new lines that have been done just because he wanted to surprise you.
Interesting. Uh-huh.
But intensively caring and always dressed up. He always had a suit on when he directed.
Really?
Yeah. He always wore like a black suit, and it was something about just that. I don't remember what he said or if I heard it. It was about having that respect that, you know, he's a director. Mm-hmm. He's going to show up and look nice. But he... Huh. I learned so much just in that, you know, it seemed like a short time, but we were up there for months. We had to come back. There were, you know, filming was plagued with the the weather problems. But grateful for that.
But folks, if you haven't seen it.
Go see The Pledge.
Watch The Pledge.
Go find it.
It's a hell of a movie.
He, and Jack really is. There's that last scene without ruining it where he's sort of left and. Sean had showed me that scene earlier that they filmed. He goes, look what we got. Look at it's just like crazy good.
Yep, crazy good. Now, a film that, as you know, people sat up and paid attention to was Winter's Bone.
Mm-hmm.
and for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And we're big fans of John Hawks. We just think he's the living end.
I am so in the same agreement. He is the salt of the earth, one of the most generous, brilliant, truly wonderful people. Yeah.
And he's, you know, that film is chilling. No pun intended at all.
Yeah.
But it is. It's a chilling film.
Yeah.
Because to be dropped into the midst of this environment in the Ozarks and to encounter these people that I think for many folks, not just city people, many folks around the country, around the world, would have no acquaintance with.
Absolutely.
No knowledge of, no acquaintance with. And there they are, and they're real.
Oh, yeah.
They're not caricatures. And you've played so many Southerners, and you know when it can tip over the
Absolutely. Over
the scales can tip a little, and you can be well.
Yeehaw,
I mean,
I was going to say,
and Del Shores has fun with that, of course, in Sordid Lives.
Yes,
you know, and it's done with affection when he does. Yeah,
absolutely.
But sometimes it's done, you know, just as a cheap, you know, quick and cheap way to convey something. But here we are with these backwoods people, and they are frighteningly real.
Oh, yeah.
How did Deborah, who writes her scripts with Ann Rossellini, how did she establish the tone that she wanted to set in that movie?
Well, I know, first of all, they spent, she and Ann went down early to Missouri for pre-production, and they ended up finding this wonderful family called the Laysons, who most of the property you see in the filming was on their farm.
Mm-hmm.
They used a lot of different areas. But while they were there, Deborah was making audio tapes of the Layson family talking and their grandfather and all these different locals so that she could then send us each the tapes so that we could all sort of assimilate. Mm. Most of us were from the South, Jennifer from Kentucky and Tennessee. You know, John, I think maybe Minnesota, but he has that small town.
Mm-hmm.
And so we all had that assimilation. And then a lot of the actors went down early, you know, to spend time. I was working actually on My Name Is Earl at the time. And it by the, you know, luck of the draw, it all worked out that I could do both projects. But as soon as I got there and I met the Layson family and one of the Layson sisters, I was like, oh, that's Mirab right there. Deborah, and she has this insistence also in Leave No Trace about using real people in some of these smaller roles
mm-hmm.
to flesh it out. And so really, all in all, I think there were maybe six or seven of us that were professional actors, and the rest were locals. The little mm-hmm. girl, in the book, Ree has two brothers, and they couldn't find the younger boy, and the Laysons happen to have a little granddaughter. That's really... That's where she grew up.
Mm.
And then Thump, the guy that plays my husband, who you're terrified of, is just the sweetest teddy bear of a man. And I don't know, she did a documentary on Stray Dog, mm-hmm. which was Ronnie Hall, the person's name. That was his nickname on a bike. And I'll never forget working with him. I mean, he just had this presence, obviously. But there's the scene in the barn after myself and my sisters have beaten up Ree, and we're in the barn, and the door opens, and Teardrop arrives. It's John Hawkes. That was such a crazy, intense night. And then Thump Milton comes out from the back, and they had their little confrontation. And so they did it the way it was scripted. And then Deborah, she would love to do this. It was so interesting. She's just so curious. She said, okay, now Ronnie, Stray Dog, which was his nickname, I just want you to talk to them as if you'd never seen a script, but you, as sort of a patriarch in this community, everybody had to read the book before they were involved with the film. Deborah mm-hmm. wanted everybody to know what the subject matter was, that they were treating it with dignity and care. But everybody in that area had been affected to some degree by the meth problem or poverty,
mm-hmm.
but the drugs. And so she's like, Ronnie, just speak how you would. And he just went into this, like, Shakespearean monologue, mm-hmm. just speaking from the heart. And it was so beautiful.
Wow.
You know, and we were all very moved. Of course, it wasn't appropriate for the film necessarily, but she kept a couple of his things. So having that, and I remember Jennifer Lawrence was asked at a Q&A one time what it was like to have to work with the non-actors. She was like, well, I felt like the non-actor with them. You know, they're the real deal. Mm. So it's just, you just soak it up. It's so important for those atmospheric, and, you know, I just love those people. I would love to go back and visit.
And she's so good in that movie.
Oh. Yeah.
And at the time, just to remind folks, we hadn't seen her.
Mm-mm.
No.
That was, I know she'd done some television, but right. but that was pretty much our first view of Jennifer Lawrence, and it earned her an Oscar nomination.
Yeah, yeah. The more I see that film, and of course I saw it over the course of time, mm-hmm. I would go to a lot of the screenings. I could not take my eyes off of her. Mm-hmm. I mean, I knew how good John Hawkes was, mm-hmm. And it was such an exciting thing to be a part of this film. It felt so real and with such a labor of love. But Jennifer, I mean, there's some moments I can't still take out of my mind. She mm-hmm. was extraordinary. And then to go on and see her do so many other wonderful.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She just has it.
She does.
She's got it.
She's got that rawness, but she's such a great girl. She's funny. She's good to work with. She's grounded. I think the world of her. So it was tough working with her. She made it very, very hard for me to get her to leave my property. Yeah. Very hard. It was like, okay, there's not much else I can say. I'm going to have to beat you up now to get you out of here.
Now, how did you feel when you were approached to play a werewolf on True Blood?
Well, I was excited.
Yeah.
I'd seen True Blood, and I love wolves. That was an interesting thing, because I rarely get offers for things. I mean, I do a little bit here and there. I still do sometimes, but I still have to audition quite a bit. Well, I had auditioned for Alan Ball several times over the years for 6 Feet Under and mm-hmm. also for True Blood, mm-hmm. and just hadn't been right. And so when this role came along, they offered it to me, which was just amazing. But I was like, well—
Just explain, for an actor's life— when you say they offered it to you, what it means is we're not going to call you in to do
right.
a reading
yeah.
or an audition.
This is just
we
yours.
We know that you are the right one for
yeah.
this
yeah,
role.
Yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, of course.
It's that relief of the audition thing, even—
Your hard work ain't been in vain
yes,
for nothing.
Yes, and even now it's like, you know, of course, particularly auditioning for a new director or someone that doesn't know you, I think it's very important. But if I'm called in to audition for a 5-line or whatever of a white trash person, I'm like, oh, come on, you know I can
yeah.
do this.
Yeah, yeah.
But for that, it was. I had been in so many times for Alan. He liked my work. He'd come to see me in plays. I think they just knew. And I always heard that I was not exactly – I ended up playing the role in a different way than they envisioned. I don't really know what they envisioned, but that's what I did with it. but it was – Oh, it was super fun. It was a great group of people. Lots of beautiful people, lots of naked people.
Lots of
And I remember my husband saw, we were watching and he saw Joe Mangiello and went, that's who you're working with. And I went, I'm the old werewolf grandma. Then there's not going to be any hanky-panky. That's little wolf chicks.
I love that as being your, now, I'm the old wolf grandma, guys.
Old
it's
grandma.
Okay. Don't worry about it.
But they were all so nice. But it was great. Though it was cold.
It was
very cold filming out in the woods. But I loved the whole transformation when the wolves were on set, and there were very strict things. You know, you don't look it in the eye. Because they'd have the actors do these physical things. I guess you have to start undressing. You're naked when you actually transform into the wolf.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't have to do that part. Thank God. But... Oh, it was and my mom who I grew up watching Dark Shadows, she and science fiction, Star Trek and Dark Shadows, so I was like, Mom, I'm working on True Blood, and I was more worried. I was like, oh God, there's a lot of nudity. Is she gonna be able to take this? Well, she was just so confused, and bless her heart. She did end up having Alzheimer's, but this was in the beginning of it, but she still couldn't quite figure out, what do you mean you're a werewolf? I see the vampires. Where are the werewolves? How does that happen? Meet your dog? You're eating your son? What's going on? You know,
sweet.
And was it Louisiana that they were shooting?
Actually, when I think they shot one of the first two of the first seasons there. We shot it here.
Oh wow! Okay.
We shot it way up on some big ranch up in the Calabasas area. I want to mm-hmm. say where they were a lot of different locations.
It'll be there. Mm-hmm. It'll be Santa Clarita.
Yeah,
that's where it all is.
That's where it all is.
Now I know that you didn't shoot this in town. Another film, another of the best films of recent years with a great part of it was Hell or High Water,
mm-hmm.
Written by Taylor Sheridan, directed by David McKenzie. And that is another film that just like a punch in the gut.
Yeah.
And again, so real.
So real.
And that's why they cast you in films like that, because they want somebody real. They want somebody genuine, not a broad stroke caricature.
Yeah.
You get out of my house. Yeah, no, it's you need.
I know it's a fine line, and there's that other woman that has a. There's so many great small roles in that, waitresses and stuff.
Oh yes, they're all good.
And she's also in Old Country for No Men, No Country for Old Men, Old Country for No Men.
That'll do. That's fine.
I need more coffee. big tall woman. I can't remember the whole scene now, but. I think she's out of Texas. Anyway, I was so thrilled to get that role, and I didn't think it was going to happen because I'd gone into audition, and then I think I went back in, and I knew the casting director. He knew me. He knew I could do the role, but he kept pushing me in this one direction, which was probably just to keep it as simple as possible. And And when I finally got it, I guess that take worked, and they could see that I could do it. And it was that scene, which is of course the first scene in the film, that was actually the very first day of filming.
Oh my!
Which was unusual.
Very
unusual.
Most films are not shot in order.
No, not at all. And David McKenzie was a delight. He was wonderful. He knew Michael McDonough, who'd been the DP on Winter's Bone, mm-hmm. and one of the producers, I think Kate Dean, maybe, had been on both. But yeah, so and I worked twice. We filmed that first day with Ben and Chris. And then they brought me back like 3 weeks later to film the little scene with Mr. Bridges. Mm-hmm. Oh, mm-hmm. I was so lucky on that one to work with
so many good people.
Oh my
God.
So
many good people in that movie.
And yeah, what a great film. You know? It's another one I could just watch over and over.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So good.
Well, it's so solid.
Yes.
It's so solid. And again, you get a sense of you're really there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You really has a very strong sense of place,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And everybody has their place in that environment. Mm-hmm. Gil Birmingham and
Gosh, the, yeah. and Jeff Bridges and yeah, they're very very distinct. Sort of like, I mean, in Winter's Bone, everybody has their place, but mm-hmm. Heller High. We did film in Clovis, New Mexico, which is like a 3-hour drive from Albuquerque, which because I had to go back twice, I can remember the 3-hour. Van drive with,
mm-hmm.
Thank gosh, the driver and I had a lot to talk about.
Mm-hmm. Oh, New Mexico.
Now, you're in a film that didn't get the same level of attention, and it's a very modest film that we happen to like called Small Town Crime.
Mm-hmm. Oh, good.
Because, yeah. So the boys, we've had the boys on the show.
Oh, Ian and Esham.
Ian and Esham, we've had them on the show.
Some Ian
I was actually just talking to Esham yesterday. I've known them since I was working a film festival that they came to, and this is, jeez, I was 19, I'm 32. I don't do math. Someone else do math. A long time.
13 years.
Thank you. I'll
Maybe.
Trust you. It could be 20. Honestly, I don't do math. But they were there, and so they had this short film with them called Night of the Dog, and they were just wonderful, and we stayed friends. So
nice.
When this came out, and I'm going, hang on, you've got all of my favorite actors in one movie. It's a wealth of riches.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm so proud of them and everything that they're doing. So proud.
They're terrific. I just had lunch with them the other day because they're looking at a couple of new scripts producing.
Yes.
And I love working with them. And I don't know. I first got introduced to them through Octavia Spencer.
Because mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had done Trailer Trash Housewife, the play with Octavia, 2003. And then, like, I don't know if it was around Winter's Bone or after. She goes, Daya, my friends Ian and Ash really would like to use you in their film. She was in it. So I did three of their films, Lost on Purpose, mm-hmm. and then Waffle Street, mm-hmm. and then Small Town Crime, which is so great, and mm-hmm. I just love John
And again,
Hawks.
The cast, it's a cast for connoisseurs of actors.
Yeah.
You know, it's not the big marquee stars.
No.
But it's all the people who deliver every time.
Every
Robert
time.
Forster.
Oh,
Bobby
Forster.
And John Hawkes again.
John.
And Anthony Anderson is so good.
Anthony Anderson is. And Octavia.
And Octavia
and Clifton
Spencer,
Collins,
of course,
Jr.
And
Clifton Collins, our Jr. buddy.
Oh,
I say
love
to people,
him. He's so great.
You are not actually an actor if you haven't done something with him. That's my theory at this point. He knows everyone,
yes.
Everyone.
Yeah.
And he's worked with everyone.
Yeah.
It's so many good people, and it's a really good film. I think it's still on demand. It was. I haven't checked in a while, but I think you can still watch it on demand.
I think it is, too.
All right, so you've done a couple of what we'll call blockbuster-type movies.
Mm-hmm.
What's the atmosphere like when you're used to, you know?
We always joke, the first thing everybody says, food.
Yeah. what's it
like being on a big budget movie? The Crafty was incredible.
Yeah.
You know, you go from Pop-Tarts to like beautiful spreads and chefs.
Of things I've never seen before.
Right.
What is this new food?
So the first one was Super 8.
Yeah.
Directed by J.J. Abrams.
Mm. Yeah.
And produced, I guess, by Steven Spielberg.
Yes, yeah.
So those are pretty good people to hang out with.
That was like a, so quick, it was like a flash in the pan. Mm-hmm. I mean, I literally was in and out of there, and you don't get to read the script. I knew nothing about that film except that I owned a gas station. It gets demolished by something. They didn't tell me what it was. And then they put me in polyester, and I'm like, well, this is fun. I really was just, like, there for a day or two, thrilled to be working with J.J. Abrams. And but, you know, I had auditioned with a completely different – I don't even know what they gave me, but they would not – there was no script. And the same thing basically happened with –
Iron Man 3.
I auditioned with something, and then when they cast me, they said, Dale, you're allowed to go to Marvel, and they'll put you in this room, and they'll give you a breakdown of so you know what's going on in the story and basically what your character's going to say. Can I tell the story?
Sure. You can tell whatever story you want.
So I go to Marvel, and they put me in this like little side conference room, and I feel sure there's cameras or microphones somewhere. And they sort of almost close the door, and I'm just in there with my five pages to get my idea. Well, I all of a sudden think, oh, gosh, I'd like to write a couple of notes down just in case I burn so many brain cells, in case I forget them. So I went out to ask the guy at the desk, and I said, would it be okay if I take notes? And he was like, what do you mean notes? What kind of notes? Why are you taking notes? And I was like, you mean like for your character? Because, yeah, nobody's ever asked that. I guess that's fine.
Oh, my God.
I didn't want them to see me, like, writing down things thinking I was copying the script. And I still didn't know until I got there, until I see the movies. I had no idea how much else went on. Mm. I just knew, you know, I was there all of a sudden with Robert Downey Jr., who I just adored working with, just in a really fun little role. Mm-hmm. And that was another set I was on for a very long time. We were plagued with weather problems in Wilmington, North Carolina. Oh. And James Dale Badge, what's his name?
James Badge Dale.
Badge.
Loved working with him.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Badge, yes. I knew there was a Dale in this.
Somewhere.
And a little kid type. But yeah, that was... yeah, it is different. There's just so many. There's just so many more people, and so many more cranes, and so many more effects, and it is like sort of being at Disneyland as opposed to, you know, in your little backyard tent camping with some weenie burns and beanie weenies on them.
Were you in front of a green screen in either of those?
I was not. I was not.
So you're the only one.
Working with actual objects and places and people.
I was. There was a big action sequence between Robert Downey Jr. and Stephanie, who plays the other agent that's on fire. Mm-hmm. And I remember they're in the kitchen, they're fighting, there's electrical wires. Well, after they came out, then there was this whole other action sequence, which involves myself and the young boy, Ty, and then he has a friend on a bicycle, and they're drowning after the water tower's been down. And we go and help Iron Man, and I got to touch his little heart thing. And it was all so dramatic and wonderful, and then they cut all of it out. But, you know, it was fun to do, and they still kept that little scene with me, which was nice. But, yeah, it was intense.
Now, we're about to see you... or maybe people are already starting to see you in I Am the Night, right?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What can you reveal?
Not a lot.
Not much, okay. Right?
Except that the fun thing was, after having done Hell or High Water, I got to work with Ben Foster again on Leave No Trace. Mm-hmm. And then I got to work with Chris Pine again on this. Mm-hmm. And it is a period piece, takes place in the 60s. It's a really terrific story. Suspenseful, you know, story, and I play a hooker, a whore, a prostitute in the 60s. So there's a scene where I'm trying to help Chris locate somebody, and I think we get into a little druggy thing. So I remember Chris said to me, he goes, "Okay, Dale, so we've robbed banks together, and now we've done heroin. What's next?"
It's beautiful that you can share
beautiful.
These things, you know.
And Patty Jenkins, a terrific director.
I just saw a trailer for this for the first time yesterday. I didn't know much about it, but even that just looks really cool.
Yeah, I hope it's going to be really good. I think I'm just in one episode, but it was another great, you know, in and out couple of days on set and working with great director and terrific actor, and you know, period piece. It was fun. So.
But that part of what is incredible about, if you want to call it day playing or whatever, is that you do get dropped into someone's world. Especially for series that have been on a long time. And you've done an episode of damn near everything. And it's just the idea that all the, you know, you come in and you sort of have to go, hello, everyone.
It's hard.
You know, it's a lot.
It is. Of course it is. I can't imagine what it is.
It's like going to a new school.
Yeah.
Exactly. It's like going to a new school exactly. over and over and over
right.
again.
Am I the cootie kid or the popular kid?
Right.
It is. I remember Tony Shalhoub gave a wonderful acceptance speech for something. Maybe it was Monk, but yeah. he was talking about having been a guest star actor on so many things. And mm-hmm. it is, I remember I've done a lot of guest star, yeah, but I can remember like on ER, where it's a show I've watched. They'd already been on the air for like 9 years.
Yeah.
Such a well-oiled machine. But there's so much going on constantly around you. And I had this very emotional, dramatic stuff as a mother. There was no place to sort of go and escape. I had to stay in this operating room. But the noise was, I felt like I was so out of place. It was just like, when it's time, you do your stuff. But I needed to focus and concentrate. So mm-hmm. I just remember going, I'm going to be squatting right here.
Right.
I just sort of squatted down in a corner and closed my ears until it was over with, and then I could get up and go.
You could focus.
I could focus. Yeah. But every time you learn something new and you just – I love to meet people. I love to meet the crews. I think coming from the theater, it's like everybody's – it's collaborative. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. particularly if I'm on a show that I'm on for a while, I'd like to know all the crew members' names.
Yeah.
And it's challenging, but it's, again, I say it's working off all those brain cells that I burned for whatever reason.
Well, all we can say is congratulations on all of the good work you're doing.
Yeah.
Oh, thank
the
you.
Good work you're getting and continue to get.
Thank you.
And we
and
know.
I hope more and more people get to see Leave No Trace. It's such a good film. Thomasin McKenzie, who is I got to meet her the other night, and her dad, and she's a gem. She's also really, she's annoyingly pretty. She's like 14 years old and perfect already. Not that I'm bitter, guys. It's all right. But everybody, and Ben Foster really is, I've watched him now for probably 25 or so years, because I started watching him when he and I were both kids. I watched him as a kid.
Yeah.
And to see him just blossom and play these roles, I'm just so happy. And Deborah Granik deserves every bit of recognition.
Absolutely. And to ditto what you said about Thomasin, you know, people are, of course, comparing, you know, the new Jennifer Lawrence or Vera Farmiga. But in essence, they're the same. She's a raw talent. She's very grounded. She's from a wonderful family. I mean, she just, looking into her eyes, though, it's like you just get lost.
Oh,
she's this deep well of, she's a beautiful, you know, she's not a kid anymore. I guess she's 18. But, yeah, that was a tremendous thing. And films like Leave No Trace and Winter's Bone, that Deborah's gift for showing marginalized people. And when you went back to, I'm sorry, go back, but okay. Winter's Bone talking about, I would go to Q&As for that, back even in my hometown in Tennessee, where you would have audience members stand up and go, it's not this kind of poverty in the United States. I've never seen this. I'm like, what are you talking about? Get in the car, I'll drive you up to Cock County right now. It's everywhere. It's in every state. And the same with the story in Leave No Trace. I'd go to Q&As, and one of the nicest things, there was a vet that came out, and you could tell he was like, you know, she just got it so right. He goes, it's not hard being over there. It's hard when we come back.
Yeah.
And I love her for that. I love her films for that, and it's a real pleasure to be a part of those stories.
It was so organic. It's one of those movies for us. We saw it at a film festival, knew nothing, which is a great way most of the time to see movies. And both of us, it ended, and we looked at each other, just massive smiles on our faces, going, wow, wow. And you clearly have that excitement and that passion, and it's important. Because to do this, you have to have that.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're miserable.
I still do. I still love it.
Yeah.
I'll still
say, great.
Reject me if you have to. But
that's great to hear.
Mm-hmm.
It means something to us to know that.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of why you're successful at what you do. Because you have that.
Even if they do keep making you mean.
I don't know. The somebody scared the hell out of me as a child. I saw some meanness somewhere. I'm pretty nice in person. I'm not going to pull a chainsaw out. I'm not going to hurt you. I'm just going to make you cry.
I was going to say, that's actually on her business card. I'm a nice person. I'm not going to pull a chainsaw out. Well, if she says that, surely we're fine.
Surely, right.
Surely we're fine.
Well, thank you so much for coming. Spending some time with us, Dale.
Thank you. It's been really fun and a pleasure to be with you both.
Fun for us. Vice versa. And speaking of us.
Us's. You follow us's. He is at Leonard Maltin, and I am at Jesse Maltin on the Twitter and the Instagram. And you can always go to leonardmaltin.com for movie reviews and book roundups and all kinds of good stuff.
That is true. And it's true that we'll be back again next week. Thanks so much for listening. Bye-bye. Maltin on Movies is sponsored today by Legion M, the first fan-owned entertainment company. They've got a lot of good stuff going on, and you can learn about it at legionm.com.